you would open to Matthew chapter 13, verse 44 with me. I am just super excited to do this. If you could put up the, I feel like I'm talking at First Niagara Center or Key or whatever it is. All right, well, I wanted to bring back kind of warm feelings that you have about your math class in school, so I thought I would title this Do the Math. But, you know, don't worry, because this is actually math everybody knows how to do. In fact, it's math everybody has already done. So what I want to do is have you revisit, check your work, as they say. I want you to revisit what it is. So let's read Matthew 13:44 together. The kingdom of heaven is like treasure hidden in a field, which a man found and covered up. And then in his joy, he goes and sells all that he has, and he buys that field. This is one of my all-time favorite parables. It's one that has a lot of depth. You can really explore it. So let's just go into it a little bit. If I said to you, what if you had a friend come to you and the friend said, you know, I've decided to really get religion, or however they would put it, and you know, I'm selling everything that I have, and I'm going off and doing whatever. You might think, wow, that's a pretty, are they telling you to do that? And they might say, well, yes, that's what they've told me. I have to sell everything. In fact, I have to kind of put it in the front of the church, and I got to sell everything I have and do that. You know, you might think, wow, what a heavy-duty requirement that is. Really, right off the bat, they're asking that? Heavy-duty, major, severe requirement. But you look at this guy and you see, well, how is he responding to this, what seems to be a very severe thing to do? He has to sell everything. But I'm looking there and it says, in his joy, he goes and sells everything he has. In his joy. Does he not see what he has to do? Does he not see that he has to sell everything that he has? But it says, in his joy. In fact, you know what? The only burden I think he has is when he realizes what's in the field and he does the math and thinks about, okay, well, how much would I have to buy this field? And he hears the price of the field. His only stress is not that he has to sell everything he has. His only stress might be, do I have enough? So he rushes home and he figures out the value of everything he has. And in his great joy, you can almost see he's jumping up and down. I've got enough. I actually could buy this field. So his only bummer wouldn't be, I have to sell everything I have. His only bummer might be, I might not have enough. If I sell everything I have, I might still have not enough to buy this field. But in his joy, he has enough to buy the field. So on the one hand, you could see what a heavy-duty burden is being imposed on him. But he doesn't view it that way at all. He sees in his joy, he sells everything he has and he goes and buys the field. Now, the difference between what we might see in the requirement laid on him and what he sees in his joy, there's only one difference between the two ways of looking at it, and that is he values what's buried in the field. We might not. We might not see the field at all when he comes to us and tells us he's had to sell everything and he's had to give the money away. He's had to buy this field. We might just see the requirement that he has to do and say, wow, that's a really heavy-duty thing they're making you do. But he doesn't see that at all. He sees the field. He sees what's buried in the field. Now, treasure buried in the field, unless we have any pirates with us this morning, they might totally get this, and they say, that's buried in the field. They might not say it that way. You know, they have the eye patch, and they do the R. But they say, you know, I get it, that he would want to sell everything that he has, and he would want that. And you might go and look and say, you know, there's a crown in there, but I don't really wear a crown. There's cups. I've got cups. You know, they're not gold. So, you know, we might not be impressed with that. In the Amplified Version, though, I really like it. They don't say treasure buried in the field. They say something precious. He found something precious buried in the field. So the real question for us, do you see how something precious buried in the field changes the whole equation? Changes the whole equation from, I have to do this really hard thing, I have to sell everything I have, to, I get to sell everything I have because I want the something precious that's buried in the field. That's the whole transaction. Now, unfortunately, this is a parable, but this actually played out in real life during Jesus' ministry. Unfortunately, the person did not do the same thing as the guy in the parable, but the rich young ruler was actually given the same transaction offered. The rich young ruler was told, go sell everything you have and give it to the poor, and then you will have treasure in heaven. Come follow me. So he had to do the math too, but he came up with a different answer. So both guys had to do the math. And this is like way back in history. This is like a calculator. So you could calculate stuff. So this is the something buried in the field, something precious. This is, quote unquote, everything I have. So the rich young ruler looked at what Jesus said, you will have treasures in heaven and come follow me. And he looked at what he had, a great deal of wealth, and he said, this wins. It said he went away very sad because he had great wealth. But you know what? We all use this calculator because we all have to do the same math. But you know, it's easy. It's easy to forget what's over here. It's easy to forget the something precious, the treasure that's buried in the field. And all we see is selling everything I have. So sometimes it's good. And you know what's cool to me about this is, see, people driving down Niagara Falls Boulevard think we're just doing, you know, you guys are just doing your church thing. And you know, it's really too bad because it's 80 degrees out and it's beautiful and we're headed to our boat or whatever and you guys are all sitting, although we're in air conditioning, so. But they might say, you know, we kind of feel sorry. We're out here enjoying nature and you guys are doing your church thing. But you know what? The thing that's really cool to me, everybody has to do this. Everybody is doing this math. Everybody is comparing everything they have to the offer of what's buried in the field. Now, the other aspect of the parable that I really like is he discovers it's buried in the field. And what does he do? He covers it up because it's so precious. I don't want anybody else to buy this field. I want the field. So it kind of is like over the top precious to him. So precious that he would even bury it again before letting any, so nobody else could possibly take it. Now, what Jesus says in the parable is what's buried in the field is, it's like the kingdom of heaven. So let's think about the kingdom of heaven, but we're going to do it by not thinking about the kingdom. First of all, let's think about the king. The king represents the kingdom. Who is the king? So I want to give you, now actually you could do this over and over and over and over again for weeks and weeks and weeks, because it says at the end of John that all the books that could be written about Jesus would fill the whole earth. But you know what's a really good exercise? I remember one of the times that I read through the Gospels. When I became a new Christian, I read through the Gospels to get information. What does Jesus want us to do? You know, I hadn't ever read the Bible in my whole life, so everything was brand new to me. If you had said, read John 3:16, I think I've told you this before, I have no idea what that even meant. Page 3:16? I didn't really know. So it was all brand new, all brand new. But one time I remember reading the Gospels, and I read them primarily not to get information about what Jesus required or what I should believe or what I should do. I asked myself one question as I read the Gospel. What is Jesus like? Because, see, Jesus is the revelation of the Father. So if you wonder what's the Father like, look at Jesus. Jesus' attitudes, his emphases, what importance he places on things, that's the same thing the Father does. So I want to look at three instances in the Gospels, because what we want to do is see, by looking at who the king is, we can see what's buried in the field. And then we could maybe have a better idea of the math we have to do. Clearly, the inventor of the laser pointer was not a coffee drinker. I know that. Could you go see this over here? This is... Okay. Turn with me to John chapter 4. These are all super famous. And this is the Samaritan woman. What can we learn about Jesus by reading about the Samaritan woman? So let's read the story. Now, when Jesus learned that the Pharisees had heard that Jesus was making and baptizing more disciples than John, although Jesus himself did not baptize, but only his disciples, he left Judea and departed again for Galilee, and he had to pass through Samaria. So he came to a town of Samaria called Sychar, near the field that Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, so Jesus, worried as he was from his journey, was sitting beside the well. It was about the sixth hour. A woman from Samaria came to draw water. Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." For his disciples had gone away into the city to buy food. The Samaritan woman said to him, "How is it that you, a Jew, ask for a drink from me, a woman of Samaria? For Jews have no dealings with Samaritans." Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that is saying to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him and he would have given you living water, which is better than this brown water that was up here." The woman said to him, "Sir, you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where do you get that living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob? He gave us the well and drank from it himself, as did his sons and his livestock." And Jesus said to her, "Everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again. But whoever drinks of the water that I will give him will never be thirsty again. The water that I will give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life." The woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I will not be thirsty or have to come here to draw water." Jesus said to her, "Go call your husband and come here." The woman answered him, "I have no husband." Jesus said to her, "You are right in saying I have no husband, for you have had five husbands, and the one you have now is not your husband. What you have said is true." The woman said to him, "Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, but you say that in Jerusalem is the place where people ought to worship." Jesus said to her, "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews. But the hour is coming, and is now here, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for the Father is seeking such people to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth." The woman said to him, "I know that Messiah is coming, he who is called Christ. When he comes, he will tell us all things." And Jesus said to her, "I who speak to you am he." What can we learn about Jesus here? Well, it says in John 1:3, that all things were made through him, that nothing was made that was not made through him. He's the second person of the Trinity. So I think of galaxies. It also says in him all things hold together. I think of galaxies and stars and planets and all of that. And all of that is made through him, and he's holding it together. But yet the full attention of the second person of the Trinity was on this woman sitting at a well somewhere in the Middle East. All the focus and attention of the Son of God was on this woman all by herself. I remember one time this story totally convicted me, because I used to, for years, have a home Bible study on Friday nights in my house. We had 15 or 20 people who would come. And I remember for various reasons in the summer once, there were only going to be two people. So I'm thinking to myself, you know, wow, we're not going to have a Bible study with two people. So I'm just about to call them up, right, and say there's no Bible study this week, till I thought of this. And I said, Jesus had a Bible study with half the people that were going to come to my Bible study, and he still had it. And he'd even call them and say, well, we're going to wait for the Sanhedrin or major religious leaders or powerful people in Jerusalem or even my disciples. I'm going to give this incredible Bible study to one person sitting at a well. And what Bible study did he do? He gave one of the most profound teachings in the whole Bible to her, living water. He taught her about living water. Not even because she would get it. She didn't even get it. She's like, well, where are you going to draw this water from? Like, what are you even talking about? But that doesn't even bother him. He gives her this incredible teaching that he has living water from which if you drink of it, you will never thirst. He gives her that teaching. He doesn't even give it at the temple with all the leaders there. One woman sitting by a well all by herself. And just for good measure, just in case that didn't blow her away, he gave an incredible teaching on worship and what the Father expects of worship. Oh, and by the way, tells her right out he's the Messiah, which crowds of people never heard. Jewish leaders, of course, never heard that and were in a trial trying to get him to say it. But he said it openly to one woman sitting at a well. Now, you might also realize, well, that wasn't just a woman sitting at a well. It tells us that Jews don't even speak to, well, they don't even speak to women. They don't speak to Samaritans. You all know the story about Samaritans. But you know what? We don't really get stories about Samaritans, because we know with our head who Samaritans are. Jews called them half-breeds. So they were actually, when the Assyrians captured and deported people from the northern kingdom of Israel, they brought some of their own people, some Assyrians, resettled the northern kingdom. Not all the Jews left the northern kingdom. The poorest people were left to work the land. So the Assyrians and people from the northern kingdom interbred. They intermingled. So the Jews viewed them as half-breeds. Not to mention the fact they worshipped wrong. They didn't worship in the right place. So what we would need, so like the parable of the Good Samaritan, we don't get it. Because to the Jews, the phrase Good Samaritan was like jumbo shrimp. You can't have Good Samaritans. There aren't any. So you know what? What we have to do is take the word Samaritan out and think about who is the most objectionable people class to you that produces a visceral effect in you, negative, when you hear about them. In the Good Samaritan, put them in, because that's the person that's doing good in that parable. This woman was a woman, a Samaritan, had been married 5 times, now living with a guy. If you're checking off the boxes for people to reject, she had them all checked out. You know, you just click check all on the screen and it just went right down. She had them all. She did them all. Jesus has to have the disciples go to town. His disciples. They have to go to town because they would never tolerate this conversation. They were horrified. What would the Jewish leaders say to a Samaritan woman if they were to even speak or acknowledge the presence of a Samaritan woman? I don't think they would have much to say beyond the word repent. Something similar maybe what we would do. What is Jesus' first thing to the Samaritan woman? He says, give me a drink. So what am I trying to say in all this? How much does Jesus value this individual? Now perhaps you might be here this morning and you say, well, God has much better things to do than to worry about me. I'm nobody. Maybe I too have all the check boxes clicked off, and maybe even people in my church look down on me because I'm just not doing well enough. I think to myself, I'm not doing well enough. Certainly, God, if he was sitting right here, would be mad at me because I am just not doing as well as I should be doing. Therefore, I'm disqualified from real fellowship with God, even though I believe all this stuff, you know. But really, me and God, God must be really mad at me. I challenge you to look at the Samaritan woman because she's got every reason to think that. But how does Jesus even bring those things up to me? Really beautifully. He just states the case. You are right in saying you have no husband. You have had five husbands, and the guy you're living with now is not your husband. Didn't really like, oh, and by the way, turn around so I can hit you with this while I say it. That's the deal. And she incredibly says, I perceive you're a prophet. And then tries to change the subject to worship, which is a bad move on her part because Jesus is an expert. So if she was trying to change this over, that didn't work out that well. But the point is that the second person of the Trinity valued her as a person. So here's something precious that's buried in the field. If there's no God, then we are here due to purely random, pointless processes. We are basically accidental. Oh, good, your number turned up in the cosmic lottery. Here you are. Congratulations, you won. But if you want to know, do I have actual value? If I don't believe in God and I believe the universe is pointless, I have to make some up. I have to derive my value from things I just make up or just stamp my feet and say I am valuable. But you really can't say it based on creation, on the universe. But the second person of the Trinity is saying to her, you are valuable. Not by anything that you've done. You're intended. Know this morning. You are intended. You can have the very same interaction with the second person of the Trinity as a Samaritan woman. And you know what? If you right now would say, if you think of an objection to that, no, I can't because, then I challenge you to say, what's your circumstances compared to hers? How are you worse off than she is that she would have that fellowship with him and you don't? So we should say, I can. He values me. Even when people around me might not, I am. So as we come back to doing the math, I'm going to ask this for the first time. So over here, what's buried in the field, the king of the kingdom of heaven has infinite value, infinite time for you, infinite attention to you. All you have to do is be there. Well, what's over here? Well, that's my question to you. What do you got? What do you got that's better than that? Everybody's going to do the math on this. There's nobody that walks out and says, well, I like scales, but I'm not touching any of this. Well, then you just said this is more than that. All right, well, maybe you want wisdom. Maybe you want, does anybody understand what's going on in life? Does anybody understand how people work? Does anybody understand why things, does anybody get it? Well, let me propose someone to you. Turn to Matthew chapter 5. I'm just going to pick one out here because there's about 47 of them. Okay. By the way, I got to tell you this little thing before. We're in the Sermon on the Mount. It's a little bit of wisdom. Him in the Sermon on the Mount. I remember reading the Sermon on the Mount for years, and it always seemed to me what the Sermon on the Mount was about is Jesus said, you've heard it said, but I say. So what Jesus was kind of doing is going to all the commandments and taking the amplifier knob and cranking it. Oh, well, you've heard it said don't commit murder, but can't even be angry. Or you've heard it said do not commit adultery, but I'm telling you, you can't even lust for a woman in your heart. Just going to crank this. So I really was like, wow, this is really hard. This is really hard. Till I learned a couple of things that totally changed the game for me. Thing one that totally changed the game for me is that Jesus was showing is the difference between the inside and the outside. This is the wisdom. Jesus was saying, you can have rules like don't murder. But on the and you're saying, like, you know, I'm not murdering this person. But in your heart, you hate their guts. You're not speaking to them. Every time you think about them, stomach acid starts to go, and you start thinking about bad stuff. But I'm not murdering them. Jesus was saying the root of murder is hating your brother. It's the heart thing that matters, not the outside things. In fact, if we fix the heart, like if you're no longer angry with your brother, you're a lot less, research shows you're a lot less likely to murder them. If you love people, I'm going to say mostly, if you love people, you don't kill them. You don't murder them. So Jesus distinguished between the outside. So if you go through the Sermon on the Mount, all those cranking things he does. So he says, you have heard it said, do not commit adultery. But I say to you, if you lust for a woman in your heart, you have sinned. So what he's saying, he's always going after the inside. It's not the outside, it's the inside. That totally blew my mind. Because you know what? We as Christians should specialize in and major in knowing to the rest of the world that outside laws on people are not going to change their hearts. But changing their hearts changes their outward behavior. The kingdom of heaven is an offering and an announcement to all of us that the heart is the problem. But Jesus said, I have come to change your heart if you'll let me. And if your heart has changed, then your outward behavior will change. So we, of all people, should know outward conformity to laws does not change us. All it will do is keep me from killing my brother, probably, but I'll still hate him. And Jesus is saying, if you think that's righteous behavior, you're crazy. That's not righteous behavior. But he's holding out hope to me. I could be different. I could be different. Do you trouble, is anything about your own heart troubling to you? Any behavior that you have, attitude you have, troubling to you? Well, the kingdom of heaven offers transformation. But you know what? I just had shoulder surgery in the winter, and right before I had the surgery, they handed me a piece of paper. I had to sign it. I had to give consent to the operation. You have to give consent. You are all possessors of souls. There is the offer that your heart, your innermost life, can be changed. Dr. Jesus Christ will do the operation, but you have to sign the consent form because you have free will and choice. And he wants you to choose and say, Lord, change my heart. So, listen to this now. Matthew 5:21 says, you have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to judgment. But I say to you, everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council. And whoever says you fool, which people probably said 37 times a day, will be liable to the hell of fire. So if you are offering your gift at the altar and there remember your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First, be reconciled to your brother and then come offer your gift. Come to terms quickly with your accuser while you are going with him to court, lest your accuser hand you over to the judge and the judge to the guard and you put in prison. Truly, I say to you, you will never get out till you have paid the last penny. You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. How many people spend time online and they read blog posts and they listen to things on the radio or however you get information, and everybody is showering you with the way that life should be or the thing you should do or what really the world is about or what point of view you should really have about the world. We all are looking for wisdom. Jesus the King, as an example in the Sermon on the Mount, who gets it about life? When I saw that insight, the problem is on my inside, and my inside changes my outside, and therefore all of Jesus' requirements are not really designed to have new outside requirements, but to change me from the inside out so that I become somebody who naturally does right. That to me was the greatest wisdom I had ever heard of. So, what do you got? So over here I have the King, second person in the Trinity, who is willing to shut out 7 billion other people and pay attention to me, and I matter to him. I also have somebody who gets it about life, how to live my life. Me, I don't get me. He gets me. Like, I've been with me for a long time now, and I still don't get me. But he gets me almost my whole life, and he still gets me. Okay, last one. Now, you could do a whole sermon series for a year. What can we learn about Jesus from his crucifixion and resurrection? There's a lot there. Let's look at one thing, and it's in Luke 23. Let me just check and make sure I'm telling you the truth here. Luke 23:32. I just want to point out one thing. This to me is a mind blower. Total mind blower. Two others who were criminals were led away to be put to death with him. And when they came to the place that is called the skull, there they crucified him. And the criminals, one on his right and one on his left. And Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. What it reminded me of is throughout history, and unfortunately not a flattering part of history for Christians, the question has been asked, who killed Jesus? So as an excuse for anti-Semitism, a lot of Christians place the blame on the Jews. They killed Jesus. And then other people said, no, it's the Romans, because they actually did it. So they're arguing. And then Martin Luther fortunately stepped in and said, it's us. We carry the nails in our pockets. And I said, yes, I carry the nails in my pockets. Let me ask you this. Who do you have here that while you're driving nails into their hands and feet are going to say to you, forgive them, for they know not what they do? How many people do you have, or your favorite? Who are the people you admire? One of the DNA questions that hopefully you'll discuss a little bit is, what do people have over here? We all have ways that we're living our lives according to principles that we think are important to us. I think you should just have fun. Some people might say success. There's as many as there are people. What you've got over here. But we all look up to people, various people. I know my students might look up to people who are in bands or television shows or movies that they admire. So I'm at, you know, who you got over here that while you're driving nails into their hands and feet are saying, Father, forgive them, forgive you, because you don't know what you're doing. You have the nails in your pockets. So while you're driving the nails into his hands and feet, His response, the second person of the Trinity's response is, "Forgive them, Father, for they don't know what they're doing." I don't even think the guys driving nails into his hands and feet would have agreed that they didn't know what they were doing. They'd have said, "We've done this hundreds of times. We know exactly what we're doing. We're trying to make an example of you to the other Jews so that if anybody else thinks of doing this Messiah stuff or trying to rabble-rouse, we'll do the same thing to them. We know exactly what we're doing." That's Jesus' attitude. Have you done anything that you feel like, well, God can't forgive this? We already saw with the woman at the well that there's no condition of a person in this room that precludes them from having contact with God. Jesus proved it. You might say, well, that was just the woman at the well. Let me recommend to you Zacchaeus, Bartimaeus, to show you examples of Jesus paying attention to individuals, even while the group was ignoring those individuals. Jesus' response to your, "Well, he can't forgive me for that," is saying, do you think what you did is a lot worse than driving nails into his hands and feet? Because for those people, he said, "Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing." So who you got? Who you got? Now we're ready to do the math, because we all are going to do the math. Everybody does the math. Walking out the room without doing anything is doing the math. I only see two pans on this. There might be newer models that have seven or eight. I only see two. This is the only one I got. It's two. You pick two things. You're the guy in the parable. You're the guy in the parable. You've heard. Now see, here's the part only you can do. Is what's buried in the field precious to you? This whole message, from my perspective, has been to try to show you aspects of the King that would make you say, "He is precious beyond all telling." In fact, I have a quote here that I don't remember. It's so memorable. "Once you come to know the love of Jesus Christ, nothing else in the world will seem as beautiful or desirable." Now, at this point, some people might agree with me and say, what is buried in the field is precious beyond all telling, and there is no cost too much to purchase that field. Other people might say, we're in church. You're supposed to talk about Jesus and church stuff. But I don't see it. So everybody does the math. My question is, and we'll close with this, is the math before us is the King and the Kingdom, what you've got. Is what you have better than what he has? We all have to answer that question. If I walk out and say, my life of just trying to have a good time, just do whatever comes, and just trying to put one foot in front of the other, that's better, you've answered the question. My only hope is that perhaps you've said, maybe there's something to what's over here. Or maybe you will seriously think about, what have I got? Does it compare to the valuation of me by God? Does it compare to the wisdom that exceeds anything I've read in the world? Does it exceed the willingness to forgive? And to take those actual points and actually do the math, do the calculation. Now, so what are the possible responses? Let's say at this point, I would challenge you, because if you still say, and you know what? Nobody can do this for you. If you still say, what I got, you know, I'm not unhappy with what I got. Then all I am asking is, will you check your work on the math? Are you willing to look into what he has to at least say, you know what, I'll do the calculation over again? Or perhaps there's a lot of people in here who say, you know what, before I even walked in here, this is way better. I'm willing to do this. But what is that? This is a parable after all. Am I supposed to sell everything I have? Well, I'm not going to take that off the table because the rich young ruler, he did say to do that. But I'm certainly not going to also say that's what everybody has to do. But what do we do? Well, you know what he said to the rich young ruler is he did say, sell everything you have and give to the poor and you will have riches in heaven and then come follow me. Now we might say, I'm willing. What does come follow me mean? So Eric, last week, put a couple of things up on the screen. They look like that. What does come follow me mean? Now these, I know, are going to be developed more fully with what people do, but followers of God have done things to follow him. In other words, come follow me is more than a sentiment. It's things that I do. So let me just say them. We're not going to go through them. But these three, deepening communion, presence of God. Boy, here's a good one for you. This week, sit on the sofa where it's quiet. Read the story of the Samaritan woman. And then just say to Jesus, I am sitting at the well, Jesus. What do you say to me? And then just sit. Can't guarantee anything's going to happen. But you know what you've just done? You just put the sails up on your sailboat. You know, a sailboat with no sails up. You put it out on the lake, it's not going anywhere. But you know, you say, all I can do is put the sails up. I can't make the wind come. But if the wind comes, I don't have my sails up. I'm not going anywhere. So you know what, Jesus? Here I am. Here I am. Deepening prayer life. Conversation with him. Deepening study of the Word. The reliable way to know what God has said to us is through the Word. I study the Word. I read the Word. I meditate on the Word. I take time. Outwardly, commitment to service and ministry. Application of the Word. When I feel like God is saying to me something to do, my new habit now is, instead of saying, wow, that's good, what's for lunch? I say, how do I do it? What do I do? I stop letting stuff go like this, and I start doing the thing, whatever. Not everything, doesn't all have to be done. That's a great tool of the enemy, by the way, is to overwhelm, well, I'd have to do everything. So then you don't do anything. What's one thing? One thing. Deeper worship of Jesus, getting worship of Jesus out of just Sunday mornings like this into your life, deeper connection to the body. As Scott said, is there any way I could do all those things by myself? Not a chance. So what I would need to do is have one or two valued, trusted people in my life that I could revisit some of those things on a weekly, couple times a month basis and say how I'm doing on the journey with someone. Those are things I would do. Now, you know what? Do you want to put yourself in the parable? What if I looked at those things and I said, wow, here we go again with the lists, right? Here we go again with the stuff I got to do, stuff I got to do. Now you're the guy in the parable. You're focused on that everything you have to sell instead of what's buried in the field. But if I view those as the means to the end of intimacy with Jesus Christ, would I do like the guy in the parable and with joy say, if these are signposts to a deeper relationship with Jesus Christ, sign me up. What your attitude is about it depends on what your valuation of the goal is. And that's what happened in the parable. Yes, Mary.
You said that. I just thought, like, kind of Right.
But do's can lead to who's. How was that? That was right. Right. But, you know, the conversation with the woman at the well would have never happened if she hadn't gone to the well to get some water that day. And she met Jesus there. And we never know where that's going to happen. Okay. If we could have the worship team come up, two things for your consideration. Thing one, you might say, you know what, I've never had this transaction. I've never heard of it as a transaction. I believe in this whole Jesus thing. Or maybe you even say, you know what, haven't believed in this Jesus thing. There needs to be at some point in your life a transaction where you say yes. If it's your birthday and I buy you a gift, and I come and I, here's your gift. You might say, I believe that's my birthday gift. I believe you're giving me the birthday gift. But if you don't take the birthday gift, it won't be yours, will it? If you leave it in my hands, you don't have it. You might believe that's your birthday gift, but you have to take the birthday gift. So one response this morning is if you would say, I have never actually sold everything I have to buy the field. I have never taken the birthday gift. I did not know that one should do that. Then I would invite you, as soon as they're done singing, to come sit up here, and I'd love to tell you more about that. Perhaps you say, you know what? I believe everything you're saying. I value what's in the field, but can I just rent? Do I have to buy? Perhaps you've been holding the kingdom and the king at arm's length, visiting. I'm visiting the field. It's Sunday. I visit the field on Sundays. And then I go home. But perhaps you would say, you know what? I can't do that because my life is not going well. What was up on the left is not working. Then I would invite you, as soon as they're done singing, to come up and to sit here and let's pray together. And again, for you to say to the king, I want you. I'm tired of renting. Maybe it's rent to own. It's time to own. And make the final payments, I would like to buy. I want in on the offer. So let's close in prayer, and then they will lead us in worship, and then I invite you to respond in some way to what you've heard.